Buchanan with the cross in towards Alfonso Davies! Canada's history-making moment delivered by their biggest superstar. A goal the country has been dreaming about for decades finally arrives.
You're listening to the Northern Football Podcast with Ben Steiner, Peter Galindo, and Alexander Gonge-Rujic.
Welcome back into the Northern Football Podcast. It's episode 120 here on NFP, and yet another big week in Canadian soccer. Certainly a lot to talk about. Not too many questions this week, but a lot of news coming out of the Canadian soccer scene, out of Canada soccer. But once again, Ben Steiner alongside Peter Galindo and Alex Gonge-Rujic. How are you guys doing?
Great. The rain stopped over here. The weather's getting nice just as I'm about to leave for Vancouver, but I see that it's going to be nice even when I arrive. So I'm looking forward to this. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys where the in-person podcast will start again. We'll try to get some patio beers in maybe while we record or something. There's endless options now.
Yeah, it's pretty nice. Pretty nice. Can't complain. Sunny, you know, not too hot yet, but right when you come in, you bring a heat wave with us. So
love it. I thought I was going to bring the rain, yeah, to be honest, so I'm happy about that.
Yeah, I mean, the rain's been teasing, but I think it's finally about to drop. So this would be a really nice time for my like pool to start working because I need that.
That's Shaughnessy Ben language over there. Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
I don't even have a pool there, Alex. So
to be fair, it's a building pool.
No. Well, you could easily dig one in your backyard. Size is not a limitation.
Put it next to the jacuzzi.
There's no source of water
or the trampoline upstairs.
Anyways, getting into Canadian soccer, lots of news from Canada Soccer's annual general meeting of the members out in St. John, New Brunswick. Charmaine Crooks is the permanent Canada Soccer president, and she'll serve the final 9 months of Nick Bontis's term. Certainly a bit of a heated election between her and Rob Newman, who was the head of Sport BC and a member of Canada Soccer's board from 2002 to 2012. Newman was the VP from 2008 to 2012 and seemed like the choice of the players, but it's Charmaine Crooks who is very much a continuation of the old guard.
Yeah, not a surprise. She obviously was a part of the board. She is a pro CSB candidate, and I highly doubt they would have let anybody who was anti-CSB come aboard. And Rob Newman was exactly that. He wanted to either remove the CSB deal, which he actually couldn't legally do, but also tweak it if that was possible. So I think we ended up getting the necessary result, or not the necessary result, but the expected result that everybody was waiting for. Now the real key is going to be what happens in 9 months' time once that term ends, because there's still a lot of uncertainty in Canadian soccer, even now, never mind 9 months from now.
Yeah, I think it's, it was inevitable. I think it's something where the holding candidate, I guess, and, you know, as Crooks was as the interim president, it was always going to be tough to unseat her in that regard. And, you know, I think it was just something where, you know, it felt like, yeah, Crooks had the support of those provincial, you know, several key provincial organizations, whereas Newman kind of came in and, you know, wanted to rock the boat, but maybe didn't rock it enough to get the votes he wanted. So I think it's something where the results aren't ultimately that surprising. And I think at the end of the day, there was certainly a lot of change on the board. I mean, we've seen all the people that have left, there's some new people added in, as mentioned as well, like Dino Rossi on the board. So certainly some tweaks, even if Crook's sticking around, and ultimately wasn't a very surprising result.
Not a very surprising result. And it's also only the end of Nick Bontis's term as well. So there's a chance for more change coming up and potentially switched bylaws within Canada Soccer to allow somebody who hasn't been on the board to run for presidential election. I would think Dino Rossi, of course, he's now on the board, would potentially run for Canada Soccer president. He seems like a guy who knows the game quite well in this country. He's been around for a long time, and I think would be a positive change to this, the Canadian soccer situation. But of course, right now, his main job is the League One Canada president and League One Alberta, about to kick off. League One BC already underway. League One Atlantic, they're looking at that as well. But getting back into the AGM, Bruce Arthur of the Toronto Star also reported that Victor Montagliani, the president of CONCACAF, had lots of influence on the election. And he apparently reached out to various voters and influenced Charmaine Crooks getting elected. So I think that's a little bit worrying for fans of Canadian soccer to know that the former president and president of the Confederation has a lot of power, even though he's not really formally involved with Canada soccer anymore.
Yeah, certainly. It feels like the last few months between, you know, Mattagliani's appearance and, you know, in front of the Heritage Committee, and even before that with, you know, Nick Bontis joining him over at CONCACAF with the board position, you know, which is a few months ago now. Certainly Mattagliani, even though he's a long left Canada soccer, certainly his hands, he certainly hasn't left the environs. And it's something where, yeah, there certainly are a lot of questions to be had about his his presence there, just because you look at some of the legal ruling and, you know, et cetera. It's, you know, there are a lot of gray lines there, but certainly it's something where, yeah, from CONCACAF, it's been strange to see his presence in that regard.
And Canada Soccer posted more than $6 million in losses, about half of their cash reserves. They plan to use the FIFA windfalls to cover some of it. Membership fees could more than double as a stopgap. And they also released their AGM.
Yeah, just a percentage pie charts, and that was pretty much it. A couple pages on the player registrations as well, which they have bounced back post-COVID, which is positive to see, and I'm sure they're going to keep growing with the men qualifying for the World Cup and then 2026 on the horizon, which is great, because that was one of the biggest worries I had right around sort of 2019-ish, was we started to see the numbers decline. And one of the reasons why we see such a deep player pool now, apart from immigration and, you know, players having different backgrounds these days and whatnot, but a big reason why registrations really boomed in the 2000s. And when you look at all the ages of the players, pretty much the core of the team now, all would have been registered as a player in Canada around that boom period. And so that was my one concern looking forward past 2026, was, are those numbers going to stay stagnated, or are they going to keep declining, or are they going to rise up again? And luckily, we're starting to see positives in terms of it kind of coming back up again. So hopefully this is just the start.
And Project 8 was also officially granted membership as a league on Saturday as well. Certainly a positive move for the women's game in this country. But getting into our MLS roundup, Toronto FC lost 2-0 to the New England Revolution at BMO Field. CF Montreal picked up their third straight win, a 2-0 victory over Orlando City. And the Whitecaps kept fans on the edge of their seat, but held on to a 3-2 victory over Minnesota United. And they're unbeaten in their last 8 MLS games, of course, sandwiched in there a bit of a trouncing against LAFC in the CONCACAF Champions League. But the question from Jordan SC at SJordan1988, who is more to blame for TFC's failure, Bob Bradley or management for not getting the players that he wanted?
Well, considering Bob Bradley is also the sporting director, I think he wears this a bit more than if he was just the coach. Now, tactically and or selection-wise, you probably still give him a bit of the blame, because when you look at how TFC plays, and I don't know if he could really influence this too much, it's still quite narrow. Bernadeschi and Insigne love to cut inside. We know this. CJ Sapong is making the right runs. He's opening up space in that regard, which is optimistic from a TFC point of view. But unless Larea is driving down the byline and then cutting inside, you're not getting a whole lot from Kobe Franklin out wide the last couple of games. And other than Marc-Anthony Kay making those driving runs forward here and there, and even then he's been playing quite inconsistently the last few weeks, you're not getting a lot of difference. And the one thing that New England did a lot differently compared to New York City the previous week was they were actually winning second balls and second phases whenever they would play it direct to Sapong, and Sapong would then try to lay it off to Bernadeschi or whoever was making the run in behind them. And they were able to get some timely goals. You know, and when you look at the makeup of the squad, the fact they have all three DP spots filled up, they've leaned into more players over the age of 30 this year. You probably say it's going to be Bradley, but also partially, you know, maybe how the club as a whole decided to strategize their squad building strategy. Obviously, Bradley's part of that, but it's not just him deciding, hey, what direction are we going to take this team? And we talked about this, you know, from the start of the season all the way into the first few games of the campaign. And you just feel like this TFC team is going to be like, they're good enough to make the playoffs, but then from there, are they really going to do much damage? And right now you probably have to say probably not. No.
When you look at a guy like Bernadeschi and you look at Insigne, those guys can break open a game. They just haven't really done that very often for TFC, and the rest of the roster isn't good enough to compete at a high level in MLS because so much is spent on those two players, and they haven't necessarily gone out and done the proper roster building to build a competitive team in MLS from player 1 to 16 to be able to compete throughout the season. And I think they have to be real worried about the Canadian Championship as well. We're recording this before they play CF Montreal, and CF Montreal already heating up. And if TFC goes out of the Canadian Championship in the quarterfinals, they're struggling in MLS. Like, I do think you have to start thinking about changes, and that easiest change would be Gar Bradley.
Sorry, Alex, I'm just going to jump in here one more time, which might set up your next point, but I think the one thing that you can't criticize Bradley for is the amount of times Insigne and Bernadeschi just play way too individualistic. The amount of times I would see players, especially on Insigne's side, making runs into the box or just running into space in general where they might be able to get a more quality pass in. Insigne's just had tunnel vision and has gone for the shot and usually would miss the net. There was one or two occasions when he was testing Petkovic, but they were relatively routine saves in the end. So it's things like that that you can't really blame Bradley for, because he could say whatever he wants to say to those two, but they'll still have minds of their own. And that is one of the areas where they are kind of hurting, and maybe why offensively it hasn't quite gotten going yet.
Yeah, I mean, with TFC, there's a lot. I mean, I think the aging players part was one. I mean, right away, the average age of the starting 11 being 30 in MLS, a league that's just constantly skewed younger. That was always a concern, especially just how I think another one where Bradley could maybe be to blame is just how high tempo he wants to play his team. Like, he's got an older team. He's got a team that maybe doesn't have the legs, and he wants to play such an up tempo on the front foot game, which just opens you up to transition moments. And MLS has so many teams in this league that can hurt you in transition because they've got younger, speedier, you know, more athletic players that can exploit that. You add in as well that they just haven't addressed the number six position permanently. Alonso Coelho's shown good glimpses there, and I've liked what I've seen when he's played as the out and out number six, but he's still young. You know, and it's something where they want to play a 4-3-3 with one number six. You're asking a lot of whoever that number six is. And, you know, yes, Michael Bradley hasn't been playing the last few games, so you can't look at him and be like, okay, well, then it's not on Michael Bradley. But even I think if he's there, not much is changing. Michael Bradley can still influence a game massively on the ball, yes. But I don't think, again, the issues for TFC have never been goals. Even last year, they had goals in them, you know, once the Italians were in, once everyone was in. I mean, now that's been less the case. But it also just feels like if their defense was a bit tighter, they'd almost be able to get more goals, because, you know, now it feels like if they allow a goal or two, it's just it's game over right now. And, you know, those are just cheap goals that you can't get rid of. And certainly the Insigne and Bernadeschi thing is interesting. It feels like the setup could maximize them more. I find it fascinating. It feels like TFC played better when Insigne was out, purely just because that allowed you to get an extra body in midfield, so you're a little more solid there. You know, that allowed Bernadeschi to cut inside and almost be a number 10, and that gave you just a bit more support, whereas Insigne and Bernadeschi are trying to find a lot of the same pockets, which isn't a bad thing. They're creative players. That's what they do. But that you offset that with the body you lose in midfield, you know, and the lack of width, like Peter mentions, and those things all add up. So I think it's something where certainly the recruitment you can look at, because again, I've said since day one, if they bought a number six, like I'll use the example, like if they had Andres Cubas on their roster right now, they would be a very good team. Like, they need a player like that desperately, and they just haven't gotten or looked at a profile like that all year long. And then, you know, secondly as well, it just feels like they're not playing at a style that optimizes their best players. I think, again, their best 11, when all healthy and on the field, it's a great team. It's a playoff team. It's a borderline elite team. But also, you know, you need to play a certain style of play with that team. And it feels like the aggressive, high on the front foot way they want to play, it's just that they're a bit too old, and some of those guys don't have the legs to play that, and it's shown at times.
The counter to that is you look at a team like Nashville, their average age of their 11 is usually in and around 29 years old. TFC's is 28 or 29, but Nashville plays a style that meshes with all those guys, right? And clearly the likes of Dax McCarty or Aníbal Godoy or players of that, you know, age bracket are going to obviously add to that average age. But Nashville plays a style that allows all those guys to thrive. And they have solid pieces around them, younger pieces like Jacob Schaffelberg, for example, to kind of do most of the running for those guys. And when I look at even now, Nashville are also maybe thinking about experimenting with like an all, and I think Gary Smith dubbed this, but basically a shorter, faster front line, not having a big target man up front and just kind of running amok with more skilled players, quote unquote. So even a team that leans into an older core, let's call it, still is willing to adapt in some ways to try and tweak and have a plan B. And it seems like Toronto, especially the way Bob Bradley wants to play, doesn't have that. And the number six part of that is massive, because look at LAFC's number sixes when Bob Bradley was there, Edward Atuesta and then Jose Cifuentes. And both of those guys were on the younger side and were just all around excellent number sixes who could defend as well as progress the ball and cover all the ground that they needed to.
I love the Nashville parallel though, in terms of the age. Cause what I like about Nashville is that they're not a team that, you know, has Insignes and Bernadeskis. I mean, they have the league MVP, but they get the most out of their players. Like, they have Aníbal Godoy and Dax McCarthy, like you mentioned. They're like, okay, sit in your pivot and mock up the midfield. Don't do any useless running, because, you know, you guys are maybe a little older. You're good defensively. You know, they're back four. They don't necessarily send their fullbacks flying forward, because they know, okay, if we get out of shape, teams will expose us. And then from there, it's like, okay, let Hany Mukhtar just do his thing, get the runners off him. I just love how effective it all is. And it feels like, and that's, I guess that's maybe the curse for TFC in a sense. And I guess, again, this falls on the roster build. Because naturally, again, like we mentioned, you look at the profile of this TFC team, it would make sense for them to sit a little deeper, play a little cautious, don't be so exposed, and play a little more in transition. But you've paid all this money for Insigne and Bernadeschi. You can't play that way. There's no way they're going to want to be there and sit behind the ball for, you know, most of the game and run in transition, right? That's like, and that's fair, right? Like, you have two players like that. You can't, you know, it's not like Hany Mukhtar, where that guy's, again, one of the nicest guys in the league as well. You could tell him to play left back, and I'm sure he would. There's not many, you know, stars of that ilk that would do that. I think it's something where TFC, because of that, you realize the way Insigne and Bernadeschi want to play. It is very strange that you look at the roster build they had this offseason. It's like, okay, let's sign a bunch of dudes in their mid to late 20s, early 30s to play in that system, really, right? Like, other than when they signed Richie Larea last year, like, how many of these guys that they've signed have been, you know, guys that can run, can play in the high up-tempo system, certainly off the ball? It is a good question to be had. I mean, even beyond the number six, right? Like, you know, you maybe look at the center backs like Hedges and Rosted, who have been very good. I'm just pointing them out because they've been very good, but also they've been very good when they sit behind the ball. you know, and you've seen a few games where a team like Philadelphia ran through them when they played a high line at Philly a few weeks ago and got exposed there. So, yeah, I think the roster build as well, if Bob Bradley knew, okay, we have Insigne and Bernadeschi, we have to play aggressive, we have to play up tempo. Well, it just feels like they didn't get enough players to play that way. And that is, again, on recruitment and as well as the style.
And from Mike Rice at Mike Rice 1983, when we looked for the winner and loser of the McNaughton and CJ Sapong trade, has it turned out to be a draw, off to a decent start for both?
For sure. Sapong looks like he fits in decently well. In that front three, he's making all the right runs. He's winning aerial duels and holding up the ball very well. He scored in his debut, and it was deserved. He was a pretty big threat in that game. And even in the New England match, he was still causing a few problems for Andrew Farrell in that match too. So that's certainly been a pleasant surprise to see, because I figured Sapong, now we'll see if he can keep this up for more than a couple games, of course, but it looks like stylistically the fit is there. And I think when you look at how he was deployed in Nashville, it's maybe not too much of a surprise, but when you have two of those guys, it can add a little bit of a different dynamic. And then McNaughton, as I think we all expected and we discussed it when the trade was consummated, McNaughton does fit in quite well already in Nashville's system, and I think we expected that. It's a system that's going to shelter him somewhat, but it will also maximize his strengths in that he's decent on the ball. Defensively, when he has to cover for someone and there's not a ton of ground to go across, he can do a very good job at that. Aerially, he's going to struggle, but you got Walker Zimmerman next to you. You've got a back line that's pretty strong in the air anyway. So yeah, so far it's been a win-win for both players.
Yeah, Sapong's been the one that's impressed me, because I think McNaughton, I looked at the fit at Nashville and I felt like he was the winner of this trade. McNaughton was, just because of the system he was going to, is one that maximizes defenders. But Sapong's impressed me. I'll say that. I think it's something where I wasn't sure how the profile would fit in. But I think he's brought a good energy and just hustle and grind, you know, little things that just maybe wasn't there with, you know, guys like Akinola and Diamande, who, again, you know, those kinds of guys weren't stretching back lines. But you know, they also weren't getting the ball to feet and making things happen. And, you know, when the Sapong trade was mentioned, I talked about him not being able to stretch back lines. And I mean, he hasn't really done that, because that's not his game, but I've been very impressed with his ability to just take the ball to feet, drop, be energetic, and open up space. So I think, because of that, credit has to be given to Sapong. And seeing that, I think this is going to be a move that works for him in the short term. The big question is, yeah, what do you do long term? Because, you know, at 34, you know, what sort of long term, I guess, viability does he have up front? I still feel the way TFC plays and they want to open up space for Insigne and Bernadeschi, just getting a speedy striker who can stretch back lines and open up that space between the lines would make a lot of sense. But I've been impressed with Sapong, and I think it's something where in the short term, he's shown that he can mesh with the Italians. He can just wear down center backs and make things happen.
And quick thoughts on CF Montreal and the Vancouver Whitecaps extending their streaks. I thought it was an impressive performance by the Whitecaps to be able to hold on, and certainly a positive return to the lineup for Alessandro Schopp. Had a key pass in the performance. Interestingly, the only player that didn't have a key pass was Luis Martins for the Whitecaps, and he seemed to struggle basically whenever he was on the ball, and attacking opportunities seemed to dry up when he was on the ball too. So if that's not enough evidence to take him out of the lineup, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like he's getting the job done for the Whitecaps.
Well, for Vancouver, to be fair to them, their underlying numbers have been really elite this year. They're tied with Seattle atop MLS in non-penalty expected goals, whether it's per 90 or total this season. Yes, they haven't played all the elite teams yet. We're probably going to see kind of what they're made of when they play Seattle in about a week here, and I'm going to be at that game, hopefully. So, that's, I guess, the one caveat you'd say, but they're starting to regress positively in terms of their attack and their defense. Goalkeeping-wise, Yohei Takayoka has been a massive, massive change. They've already experienced, now this is obviously assuming the trend continues throughout the course of the season, but they've experienced a 13 or 14 goal positive swing from last year defensively, so that in and of itself is going to be a massive change. And they just look like they're finally getting the finishing, right? And I think that Minnesota game could have been what ailed them in a lot of ways. And to be fair, outside of those, I'd say Dallas and probably the San Jose games, I don't think you can really say Vancouver's been outplayed in any match this season. I know the Galaxy won the XG battle earlier on in the campaign, but really off of that one Leerdam goal, you take that away and the Whitecaps would have won that and probably still would have deserved a draw anyways on the road. So other than that, you look at it and you think this is probably closer to the team that we expected to see from them. And then for Montreal, that for me is the really fascinating part, because Look, I'm not going to lie to you guys. I was kind of concerned in those first few games. Like, oh my God, are they actually a lot worse than we thought they were going to be? And yeah, they had injuries and they had a few lineup changes and they had a new coach and they didn't open up at home until a few weeks into the season. So there were a lot of variables there that were going against them. I don't think they're as good as the team that are winning three straight because I don't know if this level of finishing is sustainable. They're getting into the box more. They're certainly a lot more defensively organized in terms of the quality of chances that they concede. It's a lot lower now compared to the opening weeks of the campaign. You've got a dynamic runner, Mathieu Chaumière, next to Victor Wanyama now. So that's helped a lot. Sean Rea does a lot of hard running for the team, as does Bryce Duke. So there are a lot of pieces there that I think are going to minimize the damage from earlier in the season. But I don't think it's a team that is probably going to be capable of this. The Kansas City game aside, yes, the Red Bulls were facing a 10-man Montreal team, so that probably exacerbated things a bit. I thought that the Red Bulls kind of controlled that game for the most part, even before the red card. And then this week against Orlando, it was very tight, but Montreal got clinical finishing. I'm not sure that's going to be sustainable for the rest of the season, but certainly massive improvements from what we've seen. And you can really chalk it down to Joel Waterman moving to the left, Gabriel Corbeau coming in on the right side, Aaron Herrera getting into the box more, Chaumière getting into the box more, players running a little bit harder and being able to cover all that space, which is necessary in a very frenetic Losada system.
Yeah, it feels like the Whitecaps on their side. I mean, I'll keep it brief since Peter did a great job of outlining both teams. For the Whitecaps, it just feels like they're playing closer to their true level and, you know, especially the true talent level because, you know, a lot of their signings, yeah, they maybe weren't as heralded or, you know, the big money signings, but they've made a lot of shrewd signings, you know, certainly before Nikos Overhill left. We'll be remain to see if his departure maybe sees some of those signings fall off. But certainly some of these signings they've made over the last 2 years, your Kubas is, again, low-key Andres Kubas, watching him play and just seeing how good the Whitecaps have been defensively. Like, he genuinely might be one of, if not the best, number six in MLS, and no one's talking about it. And that's huge for the Whitecaps, because how many years did they struggle in midfield, especially defensively, just allowing cheap goals, chances, passes to go through there, and they have a guy who just eats everything. Like, he just, I don't know how he does it sometimes. It's just, he's so short, but his legs just are everywhere. And you add in, you know, a guy like Ryan Gold, who hasn't been up to, he hasn't even been at his top standard, but he's just been quietly churning away, expected assists, finally got one this weekend to fall. Maybe that's just what the doctor ordered for him, so he can go on a bit of a run. You know, a guy like Pedro Vite as well, poor guy, just can't buy a goal, but he's getting into dangerous spots. Julian Gressel has been, you know, just a chance creation machine. Like, you look at all those pieces and, you know, Schopp coming back and the fact that you bench a guy like Ali Ahmed, who's been so good as well. Like, you know, there's just been so many pieces. And I think what's huge as well is that we knew the offense would click. I think it's just, you look at the numbers, Brian White historically, yeah, he's maybe not, you know, he's not your Joseph Martinez, say, but he's still a striker that's shown historically that he can put in a good amount of his chances over time. And I think that's finally catching up to him. So the offense was fine. I think the big, yeah, revelation has been the defense. But I guess, as we mentioned last season, league average goalkeeping would have made the Whitecaps a playoff team. And the fact that Takahoka has been above average, it shows that, you know, when everything clicks defensively, they get their patterns, their rotations right. They're not going to concede very many goals. Even this weekend, they allow two for, you know, after their shutout streak, ones where they kick it in the own net after a bit of a rare mistake by Takaoka these days. And then the other one, well, you know, Russell Tybert comes on the field. Maybe they're a bit confused about, you know, the, you know, basically we see a bit of a departure from the midfield that's been so successful. And then they allow a goal right down the middle and a throwback to old times. So yeah, I think the Whitecaps are in a good position as long as they, you know, keep the course in Canadian Championship, keep the course in MLS. Good things seem to be on their horizon. And for Montreal, I mean, I think also in all this, we have to, you know, give credit to Bryce Duke, because I think that was, again, Montreal obviously wanted Bryce Duke a lot. We mentioned at the time in the trade, at least certainly that's something I honed in on. The Bryce Duke pickup was a good one. Did they overpay massively to get him? Yes, but Bryce Duke was a good pickup, and I think he's shown it so far. It feels like, you know, again, they just missed so much with Mihailovic gone, and Rea certainly done his part to fill it in. But again, he's still young. He's still getting up to speed, not with the pace of play, but certainly the physicality of play. And I think a guy like Duke, who's been in the league for a few years, it's almost helped Ray as well, just elevate him playing together. And they really missed a creator like that in Duke, because I think defensively they were going to improve even with Miller gone, just because they had the injuries back there. And finally, we can see that a fit Waterman, a fit Camacho, fit Corbo, what they've been able to string together I messed that up in terms of that, but we expected that from the defense, and now just the fact that they've got a bit more oomph up front, it's allowing them to just get results they weren't getting early on.
And moving on to our CPL roundup, York United fell 1-0 to Forge, Taryn Campbell getting the goal in that one, and Valor 0-0 with the HFX Wanderers, as both of those teams continue to pick up draws, but pick up points. Atletico Ottawa were outplayed and outclassed by Pacific FC in one of the best CPL team performances that we've seen in pretty well since the league was launched. And Vancouver FC welcomed the community to Langley and Willoughby Community Park in a 1-1 draw with Calvary FC in what was certainly a dramatic one, but one that was fun to be out of.
Also, yeah, how was the experience, guys? Because you guys were both there. I'm kind of intrigued to know what the first soccer-specific stadium experience was like in the Lower Mainland.
It was interesting because I've played like youth games around that area, right? So just to see the stadium there in a place that just was an old field was kind of weird and interesting. It felt a little bit disorienting. It seemed like a nice ground. I took a walk around before the kickoff, and seemed like people were finding their seats okay. It has the potential to get very loud because it's all metal like Empire used to be. Colin Elms from the TSS Rovers actually pointed out one small issue that could come up is a lot of the ground is made up, and stands are made up of metal that has holes in it. So when it rains, everything is going to get wet, not just the seats, but the concourse as well. So there's basically no dry areas. It was a beautiful day, but it does mean that it's kind of a weather-dependent stadium, and you've got to think what those attendances are necessarily going to be like in the rain. But I thought it was a very enjoyable match day experience, a great view of the pitch, basically wherever you are in the stadium as well. So it's certainly an enjoyable place to watch a match.
Yeah, they're going to have to sort out rainproofing. Certainly in the summer, there's a chance for rain here, always is. And certainly by the fall, because there are a handful of games in your September, October. Say, hey, Vancouver somehow finishes atop the league and they're hosting a final in October, November. Certainly going to be a wet one around then. But in terms of just the overall ground, yeah, it was just surreal because I've been to Langley Event Center many a time back in the day, played hockey there a few times, and it's just so weird to see a giant pop-up stadium behind it. But it was well-constructed, I think, first and foremost. I just like the layout of it. I think that's like the perfectly sized layout for, you know, a soccer team. That like the safe standing grandstand behind the goal, that is one of the best supporter sections I've seen at stadiums. Just the, you know, I love the way, like, it's like a wall almost, right? It's like a little mini wall. You got everyone able to stand it, the noise projected well. You can do great TIFOs, of course, like they showed. So that was a huge plus. I think there are a few things to tweak. I think one thing is they capped their first sellout at seats sold. And then what happened is, because I'm just going to point this out, because I know a few people certainly on Twitter were pointing out, oh, is this really a sellout? You know, shaking my head, Vancouver, empty seats, yada, yada, yada. A lot of people in the beer garden, like at least a good, you know, 100, 200 people were just standing behind the goal or sitting on the grass or sitting under the canopy or in the food lines. And I think that was something where maybe they bought seats to sit on that grandstand and then chose to sit elsewhere. So maybe in the future, if they want to get more bodies in the stadium as well, you know, sell seats in the grandstands and sell seats in the beer garden separately, because I think that would also just add even more to the atmosphere. But other than that, yeah, it was loud when people got engaged, got involved. You were right on top of the pitch. Like, what was great is that it was, on one hand, you hear the supporters, you hear people cheering, but also like you hear the players. Like when there was a hard tackle, you heard it. When someone scored, you could hear the yell. And I think that sort of intimacy is lacked at, say, like, I'll just use a Whitecaps game as an example, because, you know, BC Place, you're a bit further from the pitch. You can't really hear what's going on. You can't really feel that action as much. And I think that was a huge aspect. Like, even us in the press box, like, we're high up, right, Ben? But you could feel each tackle, each pass. You could hear the ball thumping. And I just think that's, you know, that's community. That's what you want. That's the local side. And then, of course, great to see a lot of people out at the game.
I think also intriguing, you can hear a lot of what the players are saying, and that's not because the place is quiet. Like, it's not like the Vancouver Whitecaps facing NASL FC Edmonton in 2014 type thing at BC Place on a Wednesday night. But you can just hear the players, and you can hear a very sort of exuberant crowd as well, at least at that opener. But to be able to hear the players communicating, I think in terms of just curiosity of knowing the communication on the field, it is neat to see. But also, if you're looking to have this as a community club, I know that a lot of youth players struggle with communication on the field, especially vocal communication. So if you want to put players into a place where they can see the highest level talking about, like, communicating on the field, I think it's a decent place to sort of bring youth players. But also, my one other critique would be, have the stands, especially that, like, supporters wall, a little bit closer to the pitch. I feel like it could be maybe 10 feet closer.
Yeah, no, that's fair. But that's also the last thing I want to point out. I'm happy you mentioned it. It was great to see all the youth players out there. Like, it was just great to see kids walking around wearing your Vancouver United or, you know, Mountain or Langley FC. Like, I think that was probably the most important part of this whole experience, because there's just so many kids there at the game, playing in the little, like, pop-up bubble soccer, or not bubble soccer. They had like a little pop-up foosball thing in there and all these great little games you could play, and just, you know, a lot of kids wearing their local clubs. And I think that's the biggest thing, especially, it was almost important as well that the 16-year-old Tariq Tahid came into the game, became the youngest ever CPL player. He's from Maple Ridge. He's a local guy. I think it was great for a lot of these kids to see this and, you know, be like, oh, this is pro soccer in our backyard. It's a good level, first of all. Like, the game was at a good level, and it just gives them something to believe, to see. Because certainly, you know, Ben and I, as we could probably attest to growing up, you know, maybe 5-10 years before, going to a lot of local soccer games, you know, you'd go to the Whitecaps game and stuff, but it wasn't really like as achievable of a dream. It's almost like, oh, maybe one day I could play for the Whitecaps. But it's like, everyone, right? There's a lot of teams, there's a lot of options. And I don't know, there's just something about seeing all these kids at Vancouver FC, you almost feel good for them, in the sense that they can see that, be like, oh, these kids, like, these are players that, you know, came up through similar youth systems. They can have that chance to dream. And, you know, with League One and all these, you know, new teams that have popped up recently, I think it's an awesome time to just be a kid playing soccer in the Lower Mainland, because you can look to a lot more of a future playing and staying involved in the game than maybe, say, I just say myself, because, you know, when I was younger, I was like, love soccer, always been a big soccer guy, but it wasn't something you necessarily saw yourself being a part of. It was something like, oh, I'll watch soccer, European, et cetera. I just think it can't be understated how awesome it is for the kids to see that they have all these achievable League One, CPL pathways for them to go to, aspire to, grow up and watch.
Are we going this weekend, guys? The weather's supposed to be nice.
Well, let's go. I'll be there.
There's also the Portland-Vancouver game at 7:30, I know, so it's an hour after, but, eh, you know. Gotta make sacrifices in some ways.
The Portland one's in Portland, so I don't care.
That's true.
You can watch it on the Langley Event Center guest Wi-Fi at Willoughby Community Park, if that doesn't sound like an attractive option to you. But continuing in our CPL roundup, from Dan at Rocket_Footy, are we approaching the end of Tommy Wheeldon Jr. era at Cavalry? Seems like the team has regressed in the last few years, and they look really shaky this year, of course, still winless.
Yeah, four draws. Here's what I will say. They slightly tweaked the attack to tailor it around Meyer Bevan, and recently it's looked better. I think their attacking orchestrations are getting there. It's only been four league games. I know they've played six competitive games, including the you know, Canadian Championship and whatnot, or five games, excuse me. But the big difference for me is their underlying numbers are not as strong as they once were. But I think given the structural changes you had to see, certainly on the back line, Callum Montgomery coming in, Meyer Bevan kind of becoming the go-to guy up front these days, you were bound to see a little bit of a slow start. And then because of the constant rotation with the midweek games and the Canadian Championship, that probably didn't help either. It's slowly starting to come together. I know four draws isn't great, but you have to keep in mind too, Wheeldon, I know he's been there for, you know, all of Cavalry's existence now, they've been one of the most consistent teams in the league the last 5 years, up there with Forge. The problem is they've run into Forge basically every time they've tried to win a title. So I don't think for now that this is probably the time to be calling for Wealdon's head. I imagine if it continues for another 4 or 5 games, then we can maybe start to have the conversation. But for right now, I'm starting to see some positive signs. Vancouver is very stout defensively, even with 10 men. I think we've seen that in all their games this season. So yes, it kind of hurts to only get a point when you're facing 10 men. But I think so far we're starting to see some positive regression.
Yeah, I think Calgary is a bit of a mixed bag. So there's a couple ways to look at it. I think on one way, you can be concerned because, yes, some of the performance haven't been Calgary performances. Like, the thing is with Calgary, no matter what was consistent with them over 4 years, it didn't matter if they were who they were playing. Like, some days they'd call up these guys and you have no idea who they were. They just call up a guy from Foothills and it would be Calgary. And I think the big change we saw this year is that there's only 3 Calgary OGs left. I'm pretty sure it's just Carducci, Escalante and Camargo, if I'm not mistaken, because I think everyone else is either retired or moved on elsewhere in the league. You know, guys like Mason Trafford retired, Elijah Adekugbe left. And I think that's been a big adjustment, just because one huge reason why Calgary was always successful is that they had these veteran core pieces. Like, you think back in your day, that team with Nick Ledgerwood, Jay Wealdon, Mason Trafford, Elijah Adekugbe in the middle. What was the German midfielder they used to have? It was like Julian Boucher, I want to say, back in the day. He was a fun midfielder to watch. Like, they had such a core and identity until last year. They did a good job of keeping those guys. And I think that was one thing I noted this year. I was like, okay, the old guard's gone. How can they transition? So I think it's natural. It takes time because they're a younger team this year. They don't have those mid-30s, 35-year-old guys that Tommy Wealdon Jr. leaned on to bring that experience. And I think that's shown. The underlying numbers aren't great. We've seen games where they don't look like Calgary, right? Like, that's the one consistent they always had. But at the same time, for the most part, injuries, of course, always have to be considered. And started 3 of their games on the road, right? And, like, they weren't easy games to play. Your first game on the road's Forge. Like, that's about as hard of a away game you get, because Forge had the best home record last year, if I'm not mistaken. And then your second game is Pacific away, also consistently one of the best home records across the last few years. You go and get a point in both. Honestly, you take that. Okay, you go home and draw Valor. That wasn't the greatest performance, especially because they had the first half and they should have won maybe 2 or 3-0, but they let Valor stay in the game and Valor completely outplayed them in the second half. Okay, that's a bit of a worry. And then you go to Vancouver FC, a team that was emotionally charged, first ever home game, sold out crowd. Like, you could just see how much Vancouver FC wanted it in this game, and maybe that caught Calgary by surprise. But ultimately, despite all that, I'll always say, in a North American league, if you're getting an average of 3, if you get your wins at home and you're picking up points away, it's like you mentioned, an average of around 2 points per game. Of course, Calgary are short of that, but they've played 1 home game, 3 road games. What's an acceptable minimum from that? 3 points. They're at 4. So they're slightly ahead where they should be despite injuries and starting on the road. I think it's something where once they get their pieces clicking, I think we'll start to see more of a true Tommy Wealdon Jr. type team.
And from Mike Rice, is Caden Cheung developing into a potential long-term Russell Tybert replacement for the Whitecaps?
That's been one of the most fascinating things of this Vancouver FC season so far, is Caden Cheung's transformation into a number 8, a right-sided number 8. And to be fair to him, he's done really well there. I honestly wonder how he could do as a 6 at times, because I think defensively he's actually quite underrated. I feel he doesn't get enough credit sometimes for his defensive work rate and his defensive awareness in general. But look, the good news is he could be capable of playing both positions. He could play as an 8, he could play as a 6, he could play as a fullback if you really wanted him to, either side, because he's pretty two-footed. He could be a pretty cost-efficient replacement one day for any MLS team. I know Toronto FC gave up on him, and I doubt they probably bring him back, but yeah, if Russell Tybert one day moves on and Vancouver's looking for a midfield replacement, I'm sure Cheung could slot in there. Either that or Ali Ahmed takes over, one of the two.
Yeah, and it's intriguing as well, just the way this move has happened, because it is a bit of an intriguing one. Like, take a guy who was so dominant at fullback in his first CPL go around, you think he'd slots in there, and you're like, no, let's put him in the midfield. But it is an interesting thing where it's like, okay, he had a chance to dominate the CPL as a fullback. He had the chance to make the next jump as a fullback and didn't make it. And maybe this move to the midfield is, you know, will give him more of a ceiling. Certainly he's shown very good glimpses of a big ceiling, just the way he plays on the ball already. Like, he has the hip movements of a midfielder, the way he switched the ball and showed and dribbled through guys and defensively. Peter, of course, the hips don't lie for Kane Chung. So hopefully maybe if that's the bigger ceiling that he needed, so that when he maybe makes that jump again, he could stick around. Yeah, I think a team like the Whitecaps, of course, or, you know, maybe other teams in MLS could look at that as an option.
And from David Anthony at @A_Miller16, Noonan says he'd like to see the CPL at 12 teams by 2026. What four cities would you like to see soon added in? Not necessarily the best fit, heart overhead.
Immediately for me, Quebec City. Immediately. Like, that's the first answer that I would have. I don't want a team in the Montreal area. Keep CF Montreal where it is and have them be the local team. But after that, I do feel like that is the best choice for me would be Quebec City. After that, probably Moncton. I'd say have a team in Saskatchewan, because I think that you need to have all the prairies put together. And then from there, pretty much take your pick. I think a team in Newfoundland could be really cool as well. Like, that would, I think, be a pretty decent draw. The weather can be very unpredictable out there. I know.
George Memorial again?
But, yeah, exactly. Legacy of Canadian soccer is right there. So those would be my four choices, I think.
I think for me, I'd probably do Kelowna, Saskatoon, Quebec City, and then I'd love a super small market in Thunder Bay. Get the Thunder Bay chill in the CPL.
Oh, Thunder Bay would be cool.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think give me five teams in Quebec. I don't care. Give me one in Trois-Rivières. Like, give me one in, like, Romainville. Like, all that. Give me all of it. Like, but no, I think overdue. I love the Quebec City shout. Even I'll do Montreal region. Maybe don't do, like, you don't have to do Montreal proper, but even, like, a Laval has shown in the past to do well in that regard. I love the Newfoundland shouts. Moncton is 100% up there. You know what? I'd love to see a team in, like, PEI.
So would,
like, I. Tiny place, yeah. But, like, just imagine an island just falling in love with a team. And, like, on game day, like, imagine the island's just empty because they're all at the game. Like, just imagine the concept of that. Because, you know, yeah, certainly I feel like if you could garner up a diehard fan base, and you know, doesn't have to be a huge stadium. It could be like a 3,000 to 4,000. But if you pack it all the time, and really just make it a community club, I'd love that. Yeah, give me some in Saskatchewan. I mean, maybe if Saskatoon never works, could Regina work? I don't know. I don't know enough about, you know, the Saskatchewan sporting landscape. Certainly Regina, if I'm not mistaken, the Rough Riders play in Regina. Yes. So they've always been a well-supported team in that regard.
Community owned too.
Yeah.
They even hosted some Canadian soccer games. TFC2 played a friendly there last year. I think was against Southampton.
Yeah, that's right. They've hosted a couple games, I feel, in that regard. They've also had Saskatchewan Selects play there in some trial runs and whatnot. And also, one thing on the PEI showed, I know a lot of people have summer homes on Prince Edward Island, so that could be an extra draw for a potential team out there. If people are there for the summer, they can go out and support the local soccer team.
And from Blair Donnelly, the CPL have been posting attendance numbers for the past few weeks. Is there any data from One Soccer on subscription numbers or a way to track viewership of each CPL game? I'd be interested in how many are watching or streaming.
They're not publicly available. I know that they can be accessed in some way, because usually I know for Sportsnet, for example, the Sportsnet Now numbers are usually available on the back end, but I mean, people like me wouldn't have access to that. You'd have to actually talk to people in that department to get the numbers. I doubt they'd ever publicly release them, but that's certainly an interesting proposition. I know in 2019, at times, like sort of like in the dog days of summer, there was a bit of a struggle for getting viewership. But other than that, you know, I think the numbers by all accounts are relatively unknown.
I feel like the one I'd be very curious to know are the Fubo numbers. Because that past partnership's kind of been the fascinating one, that like it was on Fubo and then the Fubo got the Premier League. So I'm just very curious to see what the overlap is there, because all of a sudden, like, Fubo went from kind of just this niche one that really only had Italian soccer to one that has, you know, Serie A, Ligue 1 games, Turkish League, Premier League. Now, of course, all the Canadian national team games and most CPL games because of One Soccer can't champ. Like, I'd be curious to see what the overlap is there. I feel like that would be very intriguing to see the if there's fruits there. Because, you know, we've always, there's always, in the first few years, it was always like, oh, you know, get it on, you know, get it on a DAZN or a TSN, because that's where a Champions League or a Premier League is. But, you know, the fact that the Canadian Premier League is available at the same spot where the English Premier League is, I wonder just what the overlap is there.
Your place to watch the Premier League, Fubo, just a little bit elusive on which one you talk about. By getting into the Canadian Championship quarterfinals coming up this evening as we're recording the podcast, as well as tomorrow. Quarterfinals begin Tuesday, go into Wednesday. Tonight, it's the Canadian Classique between TFC and Montreal, as well as a CPL final rematch between Forge and Atletico Ottawa. And on Wednesday, it's York United facing the Vancouver Whitecaps on, oh, what could have been Vancouver FC versus the Vancouver Whitecaps out in Langley? Well, Pacific take on the Pirates, the TSS Rovers, who will make their way over to Starlight Stadium on the ferry. Most of you will know at least some of the results by the time that you're listening to this podcast, if not all of them when you hear this. But any quick predictions that might age poorly in the next 24 to 48 hours?
TSS and Pacific goes to penalties. From there, I don't know who wins. I'll probably give the slight edge to Pacific, but I think it's going to be pretty tightly contested. I imagine Vancouver handles York relatively easily. I know it's probably going to be tough on a narrow pitch that York Lion Stadium presents. And from there, I imagine Forge gets through. I imagine Montreal gets through. I think they'll be pretty heavily favored. And TFC is dealing with a lot of injuries as well, which probably won't help either.
I think I'd probably take TFC in that one, just because I think that a lot of that group is probably heartbroken from last year, especially that was the first one of the sort of TFC coming out party with Bernadeschi and Insigne. So I could see them taking out CF Montreal. And then in the CPL final rematch, I think Forge have got their eyes set on this trophy this year. Atletico Ottawa has enjoyed a little bit of success in the tournament now, winning a round, but they have not had much success in their first few seasons. I think the Whitecaps handle York pretty simply, and I think Pacific take out TSS, unfortunately.
The Rovers-Pacific one's fascinating. It's going to be interesting to see what the Rovers can conjure up. So maybe the narrow pitch will help them, but certainly Pacific's well familiar. That one, yeah, I think it's going to be Pacific's to lose, but certainly at least the Rovers will be organized, and if they can get any chances, they showed they can potentially take them. The Vancouver-York one for me is the fascinating one, just because, again, Vancouver's historically struggled on the road in this competition. So because of that, I see penalty threat in that one. Narrow pitch, turf, midweek game, road game. The Whitecaps haven't won an outright road game in all competitions since June of last year, 11 months. It's something where I see there's definitely penalty threat. Like, it's big ask for, you know, a relatively injured York side to go out and win, but certainly penalty threat there. Yeah, the Forge Ottawa one, I'm leaning Forge get with the edge for that one. And the Montreal Toronto one's fascinating, because I think Toronto at home, motivated Toronto, they're going to go all out for this. But, like, tell me Bob Bradley's seat isn't on fire if they potentially lose that game. And because of that, it's a derby game. Like, that one could be, you know, could have a lot of sneaky implications to it, depending on what happens. And certainly if Montreal can go in and conjure up a bit of magic, lots of storylines.
And welcoming in now to the Northern Football Podcast, Farhan Devji, the author of the new book, Alphonso Davies, A New Hope. I know Vancouver FC fans will like it because of the Star Wars tie-in and the dark side, and the Whitecaps fans will like it because, well, he came from the Whitecaps as well. Farhan, how are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Yeah, it's good to be on with you guys.
And of course, this book just comes out, and it's the first real deep dive book on Alphonso Davies and his entire life, his career. I know the first half is very much about sort of his life, and the second half more about his career. So for soccer fans, can seem a bit of a recap of what he's done since scoring his first goal against LA Galaxy 2 at Thunderbird Stadium all those years ago. But just tell us a bit about Alphonso Davies and A New Hope.
Yeah. So like you said, the first biography of Alphonso, you know, my goal was really to, because like you said, like people do know, you know, a lot of his stories. So, you know, my goal was to, you know, dig deeper and give people like an inside look of how he got to where he is today. So, you know, that's covering all the way from, you know, the refugee camp in Ghana, you know, all the way to the site, the height of the soccer world and obviously scoring in the World Cup. So, yeah, I just hope it gives people like a better understanding of how he got to where he is and who he is as both a person and as a player.
I guess, Farhan, obviously, you're very well equipped to tell this story. I mean, we remember all the famed interview, the first one where you met Alphonso Davies' parents. We you know, back in the day with the Whitecaps. You've obviously been there since around day one. My question is, kind of when did the wheels start turning for this? I'm sure there was this point where you're like, ooh, maybe there's something I should start working on, start exploring. And kind of how did it lead to the book, which is beautiful and is well written? How was the kind of process in that regard?
Yeah, it was kind of like, it really goes back a number of years. So kind of a two-part answer. Like you mentioned, you know, was privileged to do kind of the first big interview with Alphonso's parents back in 2017. And we were doing like a mini documentary to celebrate Alphonso becoming a Canadian citizen. So I would say that kind of served as like the foundation for all of this. And when I really kind of got hooked on the story, but it wasn't until the following year, around the time the transfer was announced to Bayern Munich, that I started thinking about the idea of a book. And obviously Alphonso was still in Vancouver at the time. He was still only 17 years old, but like, it was already such a remarkable story. And, you know, that's when I started, putting some thoughts on paper, doing some research, even wrote a sample chapter like that Christmas, I remember, but kind of just sat on it for a couple years for various reasons. And then, it was around 2020. Obviously we were in the pandemic at that point. Like, I think a lot of people, and myself included, were just like thinking about what they want out of their career and their lives and whatnot. And I kept coming back to this idea of the book, and that coincided with Alphonso's breakout year at Bayern Munich. So yeah, it was around 2020 when I really started pursuing this and pitching some publishers and, you know, spoke to Alphonso's reps and things like that. And that's when it really kind of, became a reality, I guess.
And when you're looking back at your time as the Whitecaps club reporter, of course, you were one of the few people back then able to talk to Alphonso on a regular basis. What was that access like to have such a young kid within the Whitecaps program?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting because, like you said, like the media wasn't given a lot of access to him. And to be honest, like I wasn't either. Like, I did probably speak to him more than everyone else. It was, you know, and that, like I said, served as the foundation for this. Just even hearing some of the things he said back then, like actually the first time I ever spoke to him, it was February 2016. He had just joined the Whitecaps first team training camp. We were in Tucson, Arizona, and just hearing him right off the bat speaking about like how, you know, thankful he was to his parents for you know, sacrificing and bringing him here to a safe environment, and just like how motivated he was to make them proud. Like, to hear that from a 15-year-old who you just met, like that, you know, that definitely kind of stuck with me, and I actually talk about that in the opening of the book. So yeah, that definitely kind of, you know, lives in my memory.
In the first half of the book, there's some fascinating details really about just how it all started for, you know, Alphonso Davies. It was fascinating to read the history of Liberia, you know, Ghana, the reality of being in a camp and all that. When you're researching, you know, that portion of the book, what were some of the things that maybe just shocked you and surprised you about how it all started for Alphonso Davies?
Yeah, and that's where I wanted to kind of dig into the most, because like we'd heard like he was, you know, there was a war and he was, you know, born in a refugee camp, but I didn't fully grasp like what that really meant. So yeah, like a 14-year war in Liberia, like think about that, like 14 years of like, you know, conflict and violence and pain for a lot of people, and just learning about some of the, you know, history with the US and whatnot, like that was all kind of new to me. And then yeah, life on the refugee camp, like I didn't realize that in the year 2000, which is when Alphonso was born, like a lot of the aid at the camp had actually been shut down because there was a lack of funding. And, you know, there was a kind of a campaign to get, you know, Liberians to go back to Liberia. So, you know, things like water and food and shelter, like none of that was even really being provided anymore. So just thinking about, you know, how hard that must have been for Alphonso's family. Like, you know, those are a couple things that stood out to me.
And if you sort of recount your first moments with Alphonso all the way back then, just sort of what were some of your interactions that sort of stand out to you that I know you talk about in the book, but I know that some people would be definitely interested about Alphonso Davies at 15, 16 years old.
So I don't think we saw like a lot of his personality initially in those first couple of years, because he was so like, just, I think he was so keen on, you know, not disrespecting anyone and not, you know, he just kind of wanted to, you know, be one of the guys, but he knew he wasn't, because like he even said, I remember back then, he even said something like, you know, as a kid, I just go around goofing around. Whereas these guys are like, they're, you know, they're worrying about paying their bills and their kids and things like that. So it definitely took him a couple of years to kind of get comfortable in that environment and show his personality. And, you know, I talk about how, talked to Kai Kamara for this book and how he kind of really encouraged Alfonso in that final year just to be himself and, you know, encouraged him with the celebrations and the dancing and things like that. So I think that helped Alfonso get out of his shell. So that's something that comes to mind. Another cool story, I actually wasn't there, but so it was the day he became a Canadian citizen. I was in the office, actually. We were finalizing our documentary, but there's a cool kind of story where after he, you know, passed his test, there was like a lull between the test and the ceremony. So, and we wanted him to see our kind of documentary before it went live. So we have a picture of him just sitting in a quiet hallway by himself on a phone watching our documentary just after he became a Canadian citizen. And he said like, that's the first time he saw his mom cry. It's the first time he like learned some of the, like the, you know, vivid details of kind of the struggles they went through. So that's another thing that kind of sticks with me.
Obviously the name of the book, A New Hope, you know, it's, you know, I love the name, and just reading it as well, like the idea that soccer and the sport, the sport we all love, can kind of, you know, bring a hope to someone. I guess kind of a two-parter, you know, where did the name come up with within that, and, you know, what does that mean to you? And then also just like, how, you know, how powerful was it just seeing what soccer can do for people, how it, you know, a guy like Alfonso growing up in a foreign country, it kind of gave him an escape, and, you know, how a lot of people can relate to that is, you know, we've got we're a country with a lot of newcomers, a lot of people who don't, maybe, you know, they come to a new place, they don't identify with anything, and they have this sport to kind of offer them that sort of hope, and a story like Alfonso, certainly.
Yeah, it's huge. Just kind of the second part of that question, like, even like speaking to Alfonso and even someone like Gloria Amanda, who was Alfonso's, you know, good friend growing up, like they both said that like soccer was the way they made friends, and they kind of showed their personality. Like something Gloria said was like, hey, once he started playing soccer, it's like, hey, look, like I can, you know, I'm not an alien. Like I can do the same things that you can do. Right. Cause he was still learning the language and things like that. And Alfonso said it's, you know, playing soccer helped him, you know, become his self and get out of his shell. So it's huge to get integrated, because yeah, it really is the world's game and kind of a language in itself, right? So yeah, that's a really good point on your part. And then the title, yeah. So initially when I was going to pitch this, I actually had it as A New Hope for Canadian soccer, as opposed to just A New Hope. But there is so much more to it than that. Like for Alfonso and his family, like coming to Canada gave them new hope, right? That Alfonso could have a better life. So that was part of it. And then, yeah, it's how he's just like this beacon of hope for refugees around the world who are kind of struggling and want to, you know, get out and start a better life. And then it is the soccer side and how he's, you know, given hope to, you know, not only the Canadian men's national team, but also just like, you know, young soccer players across the country who, you know, dream of playing in a Champions League and things like that, because, you know, previously we didn't really see that on the men's side. Right. So now you have someone you can, you know, hopefully follow in his footsteps. So yeah, there are a few different layers to it.
And I know that he was briefly talked about in the book, but Carl Robinson, the coach of the Whitecaps at the time, was quite protective of Alfonso Davies at that point. What do you remember of those days of Robinson sort of guarding him?
Yeah, it was interesting because at times he guarded him from us too, right? Even like the internal, you know, media team. But yeah, speaking to Carl, just he shared some of his rationale behind it. And you know, the two players he kind of points to is two players he has relationships with, like Robbie Keane and Aaron Ramsey. And he tried to kind of draw from their experiences as youngsters in Europe. Obviously it's a different kind of culture over there with media and whatnot. So, you know, not an apples to apples comparison, but yeah, he tried to draw from their experiences and how they were protected. And that's what he tried to do in Vancouver. And so that meant not a lot of media. It meant, you know, not a lot of playing time initially. And, you know, he also shared some of the, you know, things he regretted about that experience. But yeah, I think, like, you know, a lot of people deserve credit for helping Alfonso get to where he is today, but Alfonso probably would have made it regardless, right? When you have that kind of talent and you have that kind of mentality, like he was destined for greatness.
Final one for me, Farhan, obviously, Alfonso's his story as a player is far from over, still super young, you know, despite this journey, he's still, you know, for certainly for him, something like a new hope, lots to look forward to. How excited are you just to see him continue to grow, continue to develop, you know, as he reaches the prime of his career, certainly, you know, going to become a lot more of a leader at the club level. And, you know, for yourself personally, you know, maybe might you add a few chapters to the book down the line as his career progresses?
Yeah, I mean, never say never. It's definitely not something I'm, you know, considering at this point. But yeah, a few people have asked, and like, hey, who knows? We'll have to see where Alfonso's career goes, right? Like you said, he's still only 22. You know, hopefully a lot more success to come, you know, at the club level, wherever that may be. Obviously, there's all these rumors going around right now. And then, but also at the national team level, like, you know, playing in the World Cup was like a good taste, but now I think people want more, right? They want to see Canada go on a run in 2026. Like, you know, hopefully this summer Canada can win something, whether it's the Nations League or the Gold Cup. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see where his career goes from here. And yeah, who knows, maybe one day there will be a second edition. We'll have to wait and see.
That's really all the questions we've got for you beforehand, but thanks so much for joining us on the Northern Football Podcast, and congrats again on Alfonso Davies and New Hope.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having me.
And getting into the Canucks Abroad roundup and mailbag, the Northern Football Podcast is proudly partnered with Canucks Abroad. Find the full Canadian player pool and daily schedules for Canadians in action at canucks-abroad.ca. Alfonso Davies was named the CONCACAF Men's Player of the Year for 2022. Fellow nominee Jonathan David went the full 90 for Lille in their 1-0 loss to Rems, but finished without a goal. Ike Ugbo started for the first time since January 8 and went 80 minutes as Troyes lost 3-1 to PSG. And from Jordan SC, do you think Ike Ugbo would be open to a move to MLS?
I think he would be. He'd make pretty decent money over here. He'd be a TAM player. And there are, honestly, a lot of teams are going to use a number 9, and I'm looking at one in the city I'm currently in Toronto, I'm sure, who would like to sign him. Whether they have the space to do it and the ability to do it, I don't know. And I imagine, you know, with the kind of profile Ugbo has, I'm not saying he couldn't fit into it. I'm sure he could do some of the grunt work and win some aerials and press from the front and be able to connect, because I think he's shown abilities to do that in the past. I'm just not sure if stylistically he'd be the best fit, but I think he'd be open to an MLS move. He could definitely go to the championship. He's proven he can score in Liga. I'm sure one or two teams will maybe take a punt on him because he won't cost too much, especially with Troyes going down. So I think there are some pretty intriguing options, but this is a massive summer for him, because just when it looked like he was finally in a situation where he was going to get regular games, he was playing in a solid league and a really, you know, in a team that was able to kind of be tailored around him, it all went pear-shaped.
I just feel like he needs a confidence reset. If it just feels like it's something where, like, say this weekend he played against PSG, and watching him, like, it just feels like his confidence isn't fully there. Like, there were moments where he popped up in a good spot. So he actually had two chances to score, but there's just so many moments in the game where he almost looked like, you know, disinterested and just like he's struggling to get in the game. And part of that's just, you know, the difference of level between PSG and Troyes meant a lot of suffering for Troyes. PSG just fizzed the ball around. That's certainly never fun for a striker. So I think for Ugbo, he just really needs the confidence, because he showed last year he can finish. We've seen his attributes in terms of what he can do in terms of hold up being a number 9. Who knows? Maybe there's a smart team in a top 5 league. Like, think of what, you know, where Kyle Laren was at a few months ago, where just couldn't get any game time with Bruges. Like, it's one of those where maybe a smart team is there. Are there any teams in La Liga, say, who need a Kyle Laren-esque, you know, rise? How does Ugboissimo sound? But jokes aside, I just think Ugbo needs a similar reset of confidence to the one that Laren got.
Kyle Laren and Real Valladolid lost their third straight game to Rayo Vallecano. Laren had 3 shots, including one brilliant chance to equalize that was saved well by the goalkeeper. Stefan Estacio had 10 minutes off the bench in Porto's wild extra time win over Famalicão in the Portuguese Cup semis. They'll face Braga in the final. Estacio also started in the 1-0 win over Arouca. Ishmael Kone played 66 minutes in Watford's 2-0 victory over Stoke City in their final game of the championship season. And Junior Hoylett went 69 very nice minutes for Reading in their finale against Huddersfield on Monday. Reading have been relegated to League One, and Hoylett's contract expires at the end of the month, so expect a move there. Daniel Jebison started in Thursday's 1-0 loss to Huddersfield Town. Sheffield United will be playing in the Premier League next season, so we'll see what happens to Jebison this summer. Celtic have ruled out Alistair Johnston for the next few weeks, but he could return to the Scottish Cup final on June 2nd, and he's certainly been the facet of fans' eyes over in Scotland. He certainly has had a lot of fans in the wake of them winning a couple of trophies, including the Scottish League. Victor Leturie and Ross County earned a massive win over Livingston to move within a spot of the relegation playoff and overall safety as well. And from Tommy Combe, at Tommy Combe 14, if Ross County are relegated, what do you think happens to Victor Leturie? Do you think he'll be signed by another SPFL team or try out for a different European league?
I think he could go to a team like an Aberdeen, a Hibernian, somewhere at that level. But he's certainly proven that he's a solid, if not very good, Scottish Premiership midfielder. And I'm sure if he's done well here, there are going to be teams... You know, a lot of teams in League One and the Championship have looked at this sort of a level in Scotland before and have gotten a lot of success in the transfer market. Perhaps a club from there ends up snapping him up. I know that the work permit might be a slight issue, but regardless, the interest will be there. And I'm sure other clubs from across Europe are going to be watching as well, because he's had a really, really good stint at Ross County since he's arrived last summer.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, to play on a relegation battle team all year and to have put together some of the performances he's had. And what's been nice about Leturie is that he also has kind of risen his level for some of the biggest opponents in big games, which is always a nice skill to have. So yeah, certainly I think it's something where maybe a team, a mid-table Scottish team that wants to take a push up the table, will see Leturie, maybe realize he's available at a bargain price should they get relegated. And I would make a move for it. And I think it would one where, yeah, I think he's shown certainly enough that he should be sticking around at the very least in the Premiership next year, no matter what happens.
Scott Kennedy lasted the full 90 for Jan Regensburg in their 2-0 loss to Hansa Rostock. And from Canamity Bible, at Canamity Bible, Scott Kennedy has been in and out of the 11 for Jan Regensburg a lot lately. I'm not sure if it's because of injury or just his manager not liking him. But if it's the latter, do you expect him to leave Germany to where? I think he's destined for Ligue 1.
He had interest from clubs last summer, and that to me is key here, because I imagine, look, Jan Regensburg are in danger of being relegated to the third division of Germany. If that happens, I reckon Kennedy's going to leave. He's an international player. He had interest last summer. He can play in the second Bundesliga. I think he's proven that. The key is he just has to start regularly. Injuries haven't helped. He'd be the first one to say that. So hopefully he ends up going to a club where, look, and this is going to be the case for every single one of them, stylistically the fit is there, and obviously the minutes have to be there too.
Yeah, I think it's something where maybe if Regensburg can stick up, not get relegated, that would, you know, maybe just stick around there for another year. But yeah, certainly the second Bundesliga is a good league, and overall across, I guess it's been already three. This is his third season there, correct? So it's something where he's shown a relatively strong body of work across those three seasons where, you know, a team could look at what he's done and take a move. Because again, the second Bundesliga is highly regarded. So maybe some teams in top five leagues could look at that. If not, certainly, you know, maybe some other teams like the Championship, although that is quite physical, maybe doesn't fully suit his game as much, although the league is always changing. Or maybe even, you know, a move to like a top flight of Belgium could be intriguing for him, you know, maybe for a mid to top table club there. So I would be very curious to see where Kennedy could go. It has been a very up and down season for, you know, for him in terms of just getting on the field, the injuries, you know, his team's overall defensive struggles. They just haven't been that same defensive unit they were before. And, you know, it'll be interesting to see if he ends up sticking around, if they stay in the second Bundesliga, or if he ends up getting a fresh start, because he's right in the prime now, right? He's 26, so could be maybe a time for a move.
Liam Miller went the full 90 for Basel as they lost 2-0 to Zurich. Derek Cornelius had consecutive starts on Thursday and Sunday as Malmo won both of those matches. He went the full 90 in both of those games. Jayden Nelson got about 30 minutes off the bench for Rosenborg in a 3-1 loss to Vålerenga on Saturday. Kamal Miller started again for Inter Miami in a 2-1 win over Atlanta United. Jacob Schaffenberg was back in the 11 for Nashville, logging 3 shots and 3 key passes in a 3-0 win over the Chicago Fire. Lucas McNaughton had 63 minutes. Dane Sinclair started in Minnesota's 3-2 loss to the Vancouver Whitecaps at BC Place, making one outstanding save on Brian White. Ralph Preso had the start for the Colorado Rapids in their 3-1 win over the LA Galaxy on Saturday. Dominic Zator started right back for Corona Kielce in a 1-0 win against Rakow. Marcus Cedinho got 23 minutes off the bench. Nico Seeger earned a 4th consecutive start for Hajduk Split in a 3-0 win over Lokomotiv. Charles Andreas Brim added another assist to his tally, giving him 11 goals and 9 assists with FC Eindhoven this season. To the women abroad, Jordan Heidema played 16 minutes in the NWSL Challenge Cup with the OL Reign against Angel City, while scoring a goal and taking 4 shots in 88 minutes against the Houston Dash. Alicia Chapman played 75 minutes in the Dash's 2-0 Challenge Cup win over the Chicago Red Stars, with Sophie Schmidt playing 65. The two also went the distance in the league loss to the OL Reign. Christine Sinclair played 66 minutes for the Portland Thorns in a 3-3 draw with the North Carolina Courage, but was held off the score sheet while Adrian Leon had 15 minutes off the bench. It's Portland's second straight 3-3 draw. Kaylin Sheridan played the full match for the San Diego Wave in a 3-1 loss to the Washington Spirit. She made 7 saves in the effort. Gabby Carl played 85 minutes for Washington. Jordan Listro was in the matchday squad but did not feature in Orlando's 1-0 win over Louisville. Bianca St. George had the start and went 64 minutes with the Chicago Red Stars in a 2-1 loss to Gotham. And Jesse Fleming started and played 87 minutes in Chelsea's 2-1 win over Liverpool midweek before grabbing a goal and an assist in a 7-0 rout of Leicester City on the weekend. Her goal marks her first in WSL play since December. Evelyn Vienne went the distance but was held off the score sheet midweek for Christian Stats in a 2-0 loss to Rosengard. On the weekend, she picked up a goal and an assist in a 4-1 win over IF Bromopodgikarna. Clara Solarisi started and played 63 minutes for Göteborg, but was held off the score sheet in a 2-0 win over Orbro. She also played 89 minutes in a 1-0 victory over Hammarby. Over in Sweden, Surijeka and Sarah Stratigakis started and went 90 for Vicho in a 1-0 win over Vakua midweek. And don't forget to follow Canucks Abroad on Twitter at Canucks_abroad and on Instagram at Canucks Abroad for frequent updates on Canadian players worldwide. And join the Canucks Soccer Chat on Discord and converse with like-minded soccer fans at soccerchat.ca. From David Anthony at A_Miller16, with Johnston rocking in an inverted fullback role with Celtic, is there a chance that Herdman experiments with this? Could be a secret weapon for the CanMNT.
Yeah, for the Johnston inverted fullback role, it's intriguing because really for Canada, his role hasn't adjusted too much over the last, you know, year and a half, 2 years. It's been mostly as a outside center back in terms of just his positioning, because certainly at Montreal when he was playing that overlapping wing back last year, I thought maybe that would be something for Canada to look at. But what's nice, I think, with Herdman, and we've seen it, is he can bring parts of what Johnston's shown and added. I think last camp, for example, in the one game he played against Honduras where he was playing as an outside right center back, he showed some good inverted qualities. There's a few times where he stepped in the midfield like he kind of does at Celtic and played on the ball there. And I think you can do that from an outside center back position. So maybe we could see more of those underlapping tendencies. And then also, depending on who's at right back, at right wing back, you could also see Johnston overlap a little more. So yeah, I'd love to see a little more flexibility with his role, just because he's proven he can kind of do a lot. So maybe based on the opponent, we know he can go forward. You know, he can invert. You know, we know he can drop into possession. I would love to see him adapt his game based on the opponent. So maybe if you're playing an opponent where you need a little more, you know, in midfield to break them down, he steps in. Or maybe a team that's so compact in midfield, he helps step out and overlaps. And I think there's a lot of positional flexibility he could have with Canada.
And also from David Anthony at A_Miller16, are there any realistic options present to the CanMNT to offer more youth camps? I know they're tight for cash, but is there a creative way they could go about this? Piggyback on senior camps, even partially based region-based camps next to no youth development is devastating in the long term.
You know, ultimately, they should be looking at any and every solution just to get these players playing together. Like, yeah, I guess even if it's regional-based camps, like even if it's something where you bring them, I don't know if it's maybe easier for them just to bring them to all one hub in Canada. And even if you're not getting any marquee opponents, like even if it's just playing a local university team, just to get any sorts of reps and looks and identifying some of these players, because it's going to only hurt long term. You want to get as many of these players coming through your system, winning trophies together, pushing for trophies, developing. And of course, it's something where the senior team isn't going to be fully impacted by it, just because there's such a strong pool of dual and trio and quadruple nationals to pull from. But ultimately, for the long-term success of your program, you need to focus on youth development. So yeah, any options available to them, I just it feels like it's just ridiculous that it's only tournaments, because those are obviously huge and you have to qualify for them. But to help do that, you would benefit immensely from having camps to build chemistry, to build stuff, because we've seen teams benefit from that.
And from Vince Alvarado at Vince by Demand, what do you guys know or make of Tahid's Can-Am U17 exclusion? If he in fact was denied a chance at the team because he wasn't a Whitecaps player, that's pretty damning and ridiculous.
Yeah, not sure completely about Tariq Tahid's Can-Am and U17 exclusion. I just wonder if it was because he wasn't really in a pro environment, they didn't look at him. Either way, I think it's something to look at that, you know, beyond maybe MLS teams, we haven't seen many players looked at, and it's something where it that should 100% change. I think it's something where you should be looking at kids in League One, because if, you know, there's kids in League One who can ball out at 15, 16, who could play in these U17 environments, certainly some guys in CPL environments. So I think it's something where I'll be interested to see, especially for the tournament proper, because if Tahid's eligible and he's getting regular pro minutes with Vancouver FC, yeah, they should be looking at him. And that should go for anyone, even outside those MLS academies. If you're playing pro, like a CPL, as we've shown, those players that we saw at the U20 level, how the CPL pro players helped. Certainly at the U17 level, they'll be even bigger, because, you know, most of these youth kids who are in Whitecaps and Montreal and Toronto academies, they haven't had that experience of playing pro like a guy like Tahid will have had. So that's something that they 100% need to look at.
And from Afrikaans at Afrikaans, with MLS, CPL, and League One Canada mostly underway, what changes would you make to the Canadian pyramid to help it grow if you were placed in charge? Similarly, what lessons can the CSA take from the men's pyramid that can also be applied to building the women's pyramid?
To be fair, I do think that what we see now is a solid, solid start. I think all you'd really want to see now is maybe even one tier below that, in terms of being below League One Canada. I know the teams like the Thunder Bay Chill, for example, are playing in the lower levels of USL or PDL, things like that. Maybe you could have some sort of a Canadian equivalent there in due time. I just think that the biggest obstacle now, and especially when you look at the Canadian Championship, would just be travel costs and the realities behind that. So I think if there was a way for the CSA to be able to help funding in that way, and I know that they are losing money, that it's probably not going to be somewhat helpful now, but that would be one of the biggest obstacles for me. And then in terms of the lessons the CSA can take from the men's pyramid to help the women's pyramid, I think that they can almost really replicate it in a lot of ways. You have your top League B Project 8. You have women's divisions in League One Canada, so that's very, very helpful there. And you just give more and more opportunities to female players in Canada. And the fact that we are seeing as deep of a player pool as we are without a domestic league before now is a pretty good sign that once we do have a domestic league and a further established pyramid in the women's game, that's only going to help the player pool further.
And from Dan Clark, what current or former U Sport soccer players should be getting more attention than they currently are? I think a lot of the top players that should be getting attention are getting attention. At least they're very well on my radar, like Catalin Tolnai getting plenty of attention in League One BC, and she's been outstanding for UBC over the years. Same with Danny Steer. Megan Sauvé managed to get a pro deal over in Europe. And so a lot of players are sort of receiving that attention. When you mentioned on the men's side, you have Junior Gekum getting his opportunity at Atletico Ottawa. You have Gabby Batar, who is a former U Sports player, standing out with Vancouver FC in that front three. You can sort of go down the list. You know, Nico Sigur, former York Lion. We've talked a lot about him on this podcast. So you can kind of go down the list of the top players are getting their chances. I think one guy that should be talked about a little bit more, and Alex and I actually had the chance to watch him a few days ago, or I guess it was last week at this point, but Michael Henman led U Sports in goal scoring this season on the men's side with the Victoria Highlanders. Now they pulled off an upset over the TSS Rovers this week in League One BC. And I think Henman should get some pro looks. But in terms of other players, I would say it's really Henman and the rest are generally getting looks if they're at that level.
Yeah, certainly. It feels like on the women's game, especially with Project 8 coming in, we're about to see a big boon, which is huge. You know, we've seen what these players have been able to do. You see, like a Catalin Tolnai. She is definitely like, if she's not going to go maybe the Danny Steer route and go to Australia, certainly she'd be a very good pickup for a Project 8 team, maybe in Vancouver. You saw last year, like Sadie Sider-Eckenberg make that jump up to France from U of Ottawa. And I thought, you know, that's very indicative of what she, is able to do. And then mostly, yeah, you see them in League One BC, et cetera. I think it's been fascinating to see someone like Eric Lajeunesse, who's a former League One BC alum and UBC alum, how at 19, he's just hopped into Pacific and didn't look that out of place in his couple of appearances there so far. I think it's something where the especially for a lot of U Sports players from BC, League One BC has been a huge boost. I know some personally that are benefiting immensely from that opportunity, and I think that will help less or help. I just think between the U Sports contracts and the CPL and now League One BC being there, there's a lot more landing spots for these U Sports players to eventually ease their way into the pro game, which is huge.
And a couple other names to mention as well. Amir Kanani, of course, getting his minutes with Vancouver FC after starring with the TMU Bold over in the LUA. But one player that should be on radars, I'm not sure if he holds Canadian citizenship, but he was with the Thompson Rivers Wolfpack in their championship season this year. Ante Grigic, he's playing for the youth ranks at Dynamo Zagreb now. He played there before as well. It seems like TRU really helped him develop as a player. He was a pretty critical member of that team, and he's back over there now trying to take a crack at the program. So certainly someone to keep an eye on. But I think overall, a lot of the top names in U Sports through every conference are getting their opportunities, especially in the CPL on the men's side and the women's side. It's developing in that way. And that's all we've got for episode 120 of the Northern Football Podcast. Certainly another big week in Canadian soccer. By the time you're listening to this, you probably know the Canadian Championship results, but of course the semifinals coming up once again. For Peter Galindo and Alex Gange-Ruzic, I'm Ben Steiner. Thanks so much for listening to NFP, and please remember to rate and subscribe on all platforms.